Dear listener, we hope that you've been enjoying the variety of podcasts that we have on our network. Now is your opportunity to help us by telling us a little more about you. Please visit jcastnetwork.org/survey and complete our listener survey so that we can learn more about you and your listening habits. Again, please visit jcastnetwork.org/survey. Thanks so much.
Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. You sit back, relax, enjoy the ride, as the case may be. This half hour, we will be featuring an interview with Jamie Wright, who's the director of the Voice Vision Holocaust Survival Oral History Archive at the University of Michigan Dearborn campus. This is very insightful. This one's going to be, and this is going to be very informed. The portion of the week is the portion of Vayera, starts at Genesis 16 and following. We have lots of wonderful music for you throughout the show. An awesome, you know, an unbelievable Hasidic story at the end. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. The Jerusalem Juvenile District Court handed down a 12-year sentence to a 14-year-old Arab terrorist who stabbed and seriously wounded two Jews in a terror attack last October. The teen was captured after being struck by a car, while his cousin, the second assailant, was shot and killed by police after charging officers with a knife. Israeli forces attacked a Syrian military position hours after a rocket from Syria hit the Israeli-held Golan Heights. There was no casualties. Last month was the 25th consecutive month that the Israel economy rate deflated. Since 2011, when protesters took to the street over the skyrocketing price of cottage cheese and other staples, the Israeli government implemented new policies that caused prices to drop just under 2% per year. In news elsewhere, the appeals court of Toulouse, France, sentenced Noël Girard to a $15,000 fine and six-month suspended sentence for putting a picture on Facebook of a man giving the Nazi salute in front of the Or HaTorah school. The Or HaTorah school was where, in 2012, a jihadist killed a rabbi and three children. The Jewish contingent, everybody's talking about the election still, so the Jewish contingent to the U.S. House of Representatives grew from 19 to 22 in Tuesday's election. The Senate Jewish contingent dropped from 9 to 8 with the retirement of California Senator Barbara Boxer. And finally, Pennsylvania became the 28th state to pass legislation banning the BDS movement as boycott, diversity, and sanctions against Israel. No state funding can be used for any cause or investment that supports BDS. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We are on the line with Dr. Jamie Wright, who is the director of the Voice Vision Holocaust Survival Oral History Archive at the University of Michigan Dearborn. How are you today, Jamie?
I'm good, Howard. How are you this morning? Or Herschel, I'm sorry. How are you this morning?
Good, thank God. So when you introduce yourself, do you say that you're the director of the Voice Vision Holocaust Survival and Oral History Archive at the University of Michigan? And just, by that time, the conversation's over already. That's quite a mouthful.
It is. Quite a long title for the archive. I think we're actually thinking of shortening it to maybe just the Voice Vision Archive in the future.
Okay.
We branded ourselves with that kind of long... that long title, but at some point, I think we need to go a little bit smaller.
Okay, so now I know what an archive is that's a big thing, a big room where they have like lots of files, and you go in there and you do research and you pull out, you know, little files and things and paperwork. What's a Voice Vision Archive?
Well, it's not an archive like that. We have a collection of about 300 oral history interviews with Detroit area Holocaust survivors. But we don't have lots of little files in folders and boxes everywhere, although we have a few things like that. Our archive is almost 100% entirely online. We have a website, holocaust.umd.umich.edu, where we post all the interviews that we've done, along with a transcript, an audio portion, and now a video portion. So our archive, you don't have to travel anywhere to visit it, although you're welcome to come and see what we do have. But for the most part, everything is online. So it's there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's completely open access. So it's a digital archive.
Okay. Why is there a need for such a thing, Jamie Wright?
There's a number of archives like ours throughout the country. There's the Steven Spielberg, the Show of Visual History Archives. There's the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum has an archive in Washington, D.C., a large collection of oral history interviews. The Holocaust Memorial Center here in town or in the Detroit metropolitan area has one. And there's also a large one at Yale. These are all great archives, but for the most part, you have to travel to go see their collections, although that's changing to view their interviews. The Spielberg Archive by far has the most, I think 52,000. And they're opening up access, but it's still very limited. If you're not affiliated or have access to one of the institutions around the country that subscribe to it, you can't just say sit at your desktop at home or on your laptop or even on your iPad and access them. So that's number one why it's important that we exist, this open access thing. But number two, I mean, the answer, and this is something we all struggle with as Holocaust scholars, is this idea that the generation of survivors is passing and there's not many left. And I think it's important to keep their voices alive, or so to speak, and to keep their memories front and center and part of Holocaust education. It's really their voices that inform, I think, more than one side of the story of the Holocaust. When we talk about, German... produced, Nazi-produced paper sources, and certainly there's tens, if not hundreds of thousands of pages of documents that were produced after the war and placed in places like the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and other places. That's the perpetrator story. That's the story that they were trying to tell. Excuse me. And it's important to have this other side of the story for various reasons.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean... we live in a world of hate, Holocaust denial, and we always have these survivor voices that to, I don't want to say combat that, but to counter that narrative. So it's very important.
Mm-hmm. Why is there a need for every survivor to tell their story? That's what it sounds like between all these different archives, that they want to get every survivor.
I think it's important, and not every survivor wants to tell their story. I've met survivors who have refused to be interviewed by any project. And actually, what's interesting is many of these other archives have also interviewed the people that we've interviewed for this archive. And what makes that, I think, important is, from a research standpoint, this idea that we can get interviews with people at different times during their life, because I think Holocaust survivor memory, although it really is centered around, obviously, that event, that's the most important event for many of them in their lives. Not always, though. It's, but this idea that we can look more at their life history and to see what their life was like after they came here, to of the United States, their life before the war, and obviously the things that happened to them during the Holocaust. So I wouldn't say it's important that every Holocaust survivor be interviewed. Certainly everyone that wants to be interviewed should be interviewed. But I also think in some ways we have to respect the privacy of those that are not interested in that portion of their lives.
Okay. If you're just joining us, our guest today is Jamie Wright, who is the director of the Voice Vision Holocaust Survival Oral History Archive at the University of Michigan in Dearborn. What's your background? What was your impetus in getting involved with Holocaust studies, Jamie?
People ask me that all the time, and I always say, you don't choose it, it chooses you. I had always been interested in the Second World War and German history, and actually more interested in Nazi governmental structures and those types of things. I hope my advisor's not listening. He was on sabbatical when I was an undergrad, and the visiting assistant professor who came to teach for him that semester offered a course on the Third Reich. So obviously I eagerly signed up for it, and it came time to pick a research topic for the course, and I had picked a topic about a leading Nazi. He pulled me to the side and said, this stuff is kind of passe. It's a little bit old. A lot of things have already been done on it. Have you thought about a topic on the Holocaust? And I said, honestly, I haven't really thought about it. So he gave me a kind of a historiographical debate about the question of whether or not the Holocaust was planned by Hitler very early on during the war, even prior to the war, or if it was something that came about because of conflicting initiatives and policies that came out of the Nazi Germany. And I wrote the paper, and I was exposed because of the historiographical review rather than a pure research paper. I was exposed to just many different points of view and arguments by Holocaust historians and other scholars. And I don't want to call it an epiphany, but I just was instantly interested. And from that point forward, I devoted everything to that, my life, my scholarship. So here I am.
Okay, it seems unusual. I was telling people about who my guest was today and what they're doing. The question that came up out of everybody was, Dearborn? Yeah, you think you're right. University of Michigan, and you think Jews in Holocaust, you would think Ann Arbor. It's like one of the largest populations of Jews on campus. So why is the Voice Vision Holocaust Survival Oral History Archive at the University of Michigan Dearborn?
Because of the work of Professor Sidney Bolkowski, who passed away in 2013, Professor Bolkowski came to the University of Michigan Dearborn early on, I think in the early 70s, maybe late 70s. He somehow, by hook or by crook, and from what my conversations with him and others, is he had no connection whatsoever to the Holocaust other than that he was Jewish. He had no relatives that I know of that perished in the Holocaust. But what he did have when he came here is he had experience in oral history methodology from some graduate work he was doing. The Holocaust Memorial Center at the time was interested in launching a project to interview the metropolitan area survivors. And they identified Sid because he had this background in doing oral histories. So he began doing them. Our first interview was 1981. Which, if in the kind of larger picture of Holocaust survivor memory and projects to collect their memories, that's very early on. There was, just after the war, there was a few initiatives. I'm thinking of David P. Boder's initiative at the Illinois Institute of Technology. He went over to the DP camps right after the war in 1946 and interviewed quite a few survivors. Back then, they weren't Holocaust survivors. They were just called displaced persons. And after that, things were kind of put away, swept, I don't want to say swept under the rug, but put on the back burner. Most survivors that came to the United States, the interviews that we have on our site bear this out, were basically said and told, you're an American now. Nobody really wants to hear what happened to you. You get a job, you move on with your life, and that's what they did. And it really wasn't until the early 80s, late 70s, when projects to collect these memories started up. So Professor Bolkowski was really a pioneer in this. He was a very kind of an unsung scholar. Lots of people have heard of him, but not as many as should be. So that's how the archive ended up at Dearborn. He was teaching here, and he decided to use the interviews, the tapes that he was interviewing people with in his own class on the Holocaust at U of M Dearborn. So he put them on reserve in the library. Early stories tell that he was actually letting the students borrow the master tapes, and we all know how that can go sometimes. Whoops, I hit record instead of play. So the library got involved, started making duplicate copies, things like that, and then they decided to launch this archive. Mm. So that's how it ended up in Dearborn. It's kind of a strange place for it to be. Not a lot of people know about it, but we're working very hard to get the word out. So I appreciate you allowing me on your show today.
It is our honor. So if I come down to the University of Dearborn and I wanted to say do some research, what's doing at your brick-and-mortar facility for the Voice Vision Holocaust Survivor Oral History Archive?
Well, we have all the transcripts, have all been bound and published in-house, but they're available for use in-house or to be checked out. We have all the original videotapes, or copies, obviously, of the videos, and we have copies of all the audio. So you could come down. I have a room in the archive, kind of a listening, watching room where you can sit down. You can watch the interviews or listen to them. And then about 10 years ago, I had a donor, Steve Gershman, who was very gracious in setting up a fund of some money that allowed us to purchase a large reference collection that deals specifically with the Holocaust and Holocaust survivor memory. So they can come in, they can watch the interviews, listen to the interviews. If they have questions that need answered, I'm there as a resource. And then we have this large reference collection that they can also use.
Okay. I understand you have a special exhibit going on right now, Jamie?
The dean's office, the dean, Marty Hershock of the College of Arts Sciences and Letters and the Voice Vision Archive are co-sponsoring, along with the Polish Mission and the Berkowitz Gallery, are co-sponsoring an exhibit called Forbidden Art, which is artwork that was done by prisoners in Auschwitz. It's on loan from the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum in Poland. It's a wonderful exhibit. It really is a testament to the power of people holding on to creativity, to being creative under these horrible, horrible circumstances, under pain of death. If they were caught doing these things, they would have instantaneously been executed. So it's about 30 or 40 pieces that are in throughout the gallery, different examples of all this different kind of prisoner artwork that was created, mostly in Auschwitz, but in some other camps as well.
Okay, give us... Go ahead, I'm sorry. Finish off your sentence.
Well, I was just going to say, it's actually just a small sampling of what is available in Poland at the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum.
Okay, so if you could tell me, let's focus on this a little bit, because this is intriguing, because I didn't know that there were actually such things. And the way life in the camps was described to me is, how could anybody possibly have the time or inclination to paint? So first the question, what medium or media are these paintings?
Well, the paint, there's a lot of pencil drawings, ink drawings. That's the most part. There are some small sculptural physical items that we couldn't get with the exhibit. Because they don't travel. But you have to understand that most of the prisoners in Auschwitz, and a lot of this artwork that's on loan here, were done not so much by Jewish prisoners, but by Polish prisoners, who were the first people who were actually sent to Auschwitz, to the main camp there, Auschwitz I. But they were able to do what they call, organizing, so they could trade things for other things. The camp itself had its own kind of underground economy. And people who wanted to express their feelings through art were able to get this material. Sometimes it was, scraps of paper, little pieces of charcoal. The human will, I think, under duress is a lot more powerful than we give it credit for. Mm-hmm. So, they had the will to create this material, and they created it, and it survived. It's a wonderful testament to a dark time, right? So.
Indeed. So it's just what intrigues me is, how did these works survive Auschwitz?
Sure. In many cases, they were hidden. Actually, some of the works, at least, you have to remember, too, that in many cases, the German overseers, the German guards and administrators at the camp themselves never had a problem using the Jews and the other prisoners for their own ends. So we have examples of Jewish tailors who were forced to work on Nazi uniforms, Jewish musicians who, you know, there's always the story of the band at Auschwitz that played as the prisoners would march back into the camp, or later on at Birkenau where the gas chambers were, that would be playing in the background as the trains arrived in an attempt to calm the prisoners. But, you know, they also would use them for self-portraits, things like that. So some of it survived through the perpetrators themselves. Some of it was hidden. Some of it was buried, later on discovered. So, I mean, it survived. How, in every specific case, I can't give you an answer other than it was hidden. Sometimes it was smuggled out. It just depended on the circumstances. You know, Auschwitz, as a Holocaust scholar, we call Auschwitz, I've heard it, Planet Auschwitz. It's a whole other world. It's a whole other kind of physical, spatial, temporal, mental construct. And anything could happen there.
Understood. Are there any, biographical information? Is there any biographical information about any of the artists?
Yes, there is a book that came out, and it's for sale through the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum. If people are interested, they can go on their website and purchase it. And I had purchased a couple copies for the library where the archive is and for the archive that talks about the works in the exhibit and talks about some of the artists.
Mm-hmm. Could you give us an example of one of the pictures and then describe what the background between the artists by the artist?
Sure, certainly. So there's a very interesting one, and this is because it comes from my own personal experience visiting the camp last summer of 2015, and again over this summer, of a house at one of the subcamps called Budi, B-U-D-Y, Budi 2, which was a subcamp of Auschwitz for women. And one of the pieces on exhibit is a painting of this house that one of the prisoners did for the women. I don't know the background, how it got smuggled to them, how they managed to get it. But it's very interesting because the picture itself is very colorfully painted. It's very bright. It portrays a very bright picture. The house is lovely looking. There's flowers. It shows women sitting outside in civilian clothing. Excuse me. And what's interesting about that is at this house in this subcamp called Budi 2, there was a horrible massacre one night of the guards massacring these French women who were in this house. And it was so bad that the commandant of Auschwitz actually had to intervene and I think in some cases punish these guards for what had happened. And so it just was an interesting a contrast, because I hadn't visited it now, and it looks nothing like that. It's actually the storehouse for a group of gentlemen, Polish people, who have been going around the communities around Auschwitz for the last 20 years, collecting artifacts from the people who inherited things from the camp. So when the camp was liberated, the Nazis left everything there. Lots of prisoners stayed. Some went on these death marches. But afterwards, the Polish population surrounding the camp went into the camp and took things that they thought could be of use around the house. So bunks, little objects, all sorts of things. So all this stuff that was in the camp makes its way out into the community. And then these guys have been going back through and collecting all these artifacts and then putting them in. They have two central locations here at this Budi camp I was just talking about, this house, and another one at a subcamp called Yavishovitsa or Yavishovitz. And so this house at Budi 2 is very central. It's a central to this narrative of what happened in these subcamps, and it's very kind of a newly discovered thing. So I think this contrast between what that house symbolizes for me as a visitor And the way it's portrayed in this painting is just amazing. And I do want to say, I've been studying the Holocaust for over 20 years now as a scholar, and I'm amazed, and I'm actually heartened and amazed that we continue to just find out new things about this horrible event. At one point, if you'd asked me, I would have said there's really nothing new we can learn. All the documents have been uncovered. All the books have been written. At this point, everything seems to be a little bit derivative. But I'm just blown away at all the new scholarship and new approaches to research and the new things that we're finding out. And it's disheartening that it has to be about such a horrible topic. But in the same way, I'm glad that people are still interested and they're still pushing the envelope. I was at a conference in California over last week of top Holocaust scholars in the field, and I chaired a panel on new media and the Holocaust. So with some young scholars who are now looking at different ways that memory of the Holocaust and memory of the camps is now being portrayed on the internet through new media. So it's just wonderful that the field keeps continuing forward, and I hope it continues to keep continuing forward, and I hope Voice Vision, the archive, can be, a piece of that.
Okay. If you're just joining us, again, our guest is Dr. Jamie Wright, who is the director of the Voice Vision Holocaust Survival Oral History Archive at the University of Michigan in Dearborn. There is always a very minor but very vocal, I wouldn't call it a movement, it's not big enough, of Holocaust denial, which seems, I really don't understand how anybody could possibly, but I'm envisioning it in Dearborn, the general population over there, and you teach a course in Holocaust studies. Have you encountered deniers on any type of official or unofficial basis, and what's your reply?
I never have. I guess, actually, I think once on our Facebook page, we have a Facebook page, Talk About New Media, right? And somebody had posted something silly about I don't even remember what the message was. I tend not to look too deeply at it. And I specifically said to them, I'm going to leave this up here just to prove, just going to leave it and let people decide for themselves, right? And I, in my classes, I've never had a problem. Obviously, when you talk about Dearborn, we're talking about a large population of Muslims and Muslim students, and they take the Holocaust class. And I find them to be fascinated by the subject. They're very empathetic. I think in some ways they see parallels between what happens in their lives or what is happening in some cases in the Middle East, although I don't encourage them to make these direct parallels, but they come to it with a very open mind. Or if they come to it with a closed mind, they leave with an open mind. And I don't say that because I'm saying that my teaching is changing their mind or that I'm a great scholar or educator or anything like that. But the subject speaks for itself, and if you take them there, you let them discover on their own, and I see a lot of transformations, and it's wonderful. And some of the best students in the Holocaust class are from the Middle East. So
fascinating.
I think there's an empathy there built in for them that we don't always think about. And, many of the students where I teach, the Muslim and Middle Eastern students, are second and third generation now. And they're so thoroughly Americanized, if that's the word I can use. So, no, there's never been any official things or unofficial things. No one's, I've been greeted with nothing but warmth by the community in Dearborn. And our chancellor at the University of Michigan Dearborn, Dan Brutal, is very committed to Holocaust education. He's committed to an open campus and a welcoming campus for all. And that message is very powerful, and I think it trickles down through the faculty and the students.
Okay. We have time for one more question. Recently, the state of Michigan mandated that, I think it's middle school and high school students, have a unit in Holocaust studies. So how important is it that every kid in the state of Michigan actually spend time learning about the Holocaust, Jamie Wright?
Certainly. And, you know, the obvious kind of answer that people always want to give is, if we teach it and they understand, it will never happen again. But we history since 1945 has borne out the idea that that just doesn't work, right? It's happened over and over and over in other places. Cambodia, Rwanda, Sudan right now,
Syria.
To some extent, yes. So we haven't learned. We haven't, despite, you know, years of education and talking about it. And, you know, let's face it, since at least the mid-1980s, early 1990s, you know, Holocaust memory in America has really come more to the forefront. So it's not like it's a hidden subject that people aren't familiar with or anything like that. It's important, though, I think, because we need to learn empathy. The Holocaust at its root is caused, yes, by anti-Semitism and other things, but it's caused by a lack of empathy and a lack of understanding people who are different from you. And if this Holocaust education mandate can just teach empathy, then I think that's worth it. That, you know, understanding, empathy, this leads to tolerance for all of us. I just think it's important. You know, anti-bullying is important as well, but I'm not sure, you know, I think the empathy piece fits in with that. But, you know, I don't necessarily think we can teach anti-bullying. We can make people aware that bullying is bad. It's always been bad. But it's nothing new either, right? It's, I think, more pronounced nowadays with social media and the internet. But it's really got to be empathy, and we have to understand people and understand their differences and embrace their differences and have them understand us and embrace our differences and our cultures. And, you know, it's a big country. There's room for everybody here, right? That's what we were based on. And we just have to, you know, if that's the only positive thing we can get out of the Holocaust, I think it's worth it. Professor Bukowski, you know, was a mentor of mine and a friend and a colleague. And, you know, he always struggled with trying to find anything positive to come out of this. And I think near the end of his life, he did finally come to the idea that it was empathy. Empathy and learning empathy and understanding is what, if we can take anything from this, that's it, that we have to do that. Okay. Because if we don't, it's going to continue to happen and continue to happen.
Very, very true. People want to check out the archive. What's the website, Jamie Wright?
Sure. It's holocaust.umd, like University of Michigan Dearborn, .umich.edu, or if you don't feel like typing that URL in, just type Voice Vision Holocaust into your Google browser or Yahoo or whatever you're using, and should be one of the top things that comes up. And I welcome everybody to come, listen to the interviews, read the transcripts, watch the videos. We have some wonderful special collections that we've worked with teachers across the country on using the interviews in their classrooms and some really creative things that they've done. We have an online Holocaust curriculum called, Life Unworthy of Life, which was published in 1987 by Professor Bukowski at the Center for the Study of the Child here in Michigan. It's out of print, but we managed to put an online version of it. So it has wonderful lesson plans, wonderful in-class activities for the students to do. It uses clips from the interviews. Everything's up there. So Michigan teachers who are going to start embarking on this, trying to teach the Holocaust as part of this new mandate, I welcome you. Just click on For Educators on the website. And there's plenty of stuff you can look at. And this curriculum is wonderful. It won many awards in its time. And I think it still stands today as one of the better curriculums for secondary school teachers to use in teaching the Holocaust.
Okay, wonderful. Our guest has been Dr. Jamie Wright, who is the director of the Voice Vision Holocaust Survival Oral History Archive of the University of Michigan, Dearborn, soon to be called the Voice Vision Archive.
The Voice Vision Archive.
Yes, and thank you so much, and please keep us apprised of future developments at the Voice Vision Archive.
We will do that. Thank you very much, Herschel. I appreciate you having me on today.
Like I said, it's been our honor. Okay, that's going to wrap it up here. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Some things are better the way they used to be, like the crisp feel of a cool autumn day, the serenity of a baby sleeping, or the feeling of coming home after a long trip. Franklin Cider Mills makes cider the way cider is supposed to be. Its old-fashioned, clear, crisp taste reminds you of a cool autumn day. Located in the heart of historic Franklin Village at 14 Mile and Franklin Road, Franklin Cider Mill has been making cider the same way for over a century. Always fresh, with no additives or preservatives. You just can't buy Franklin Cider in any supermarket. Franklin Cider Mill is open from Labor Day weekend to after Thanksgiving from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Come visit Franklin Cider Mill. It's kind of like coming home.
Want assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. Up next, for your listening pleasure, this is the Mutti Miller Avram Blatty Ensemble, and the piece we're playing is simply called A Klezmer Freilich, which means happy song.
Oh,
Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Herschel Finman here. We have time for one more. This is Mutti Friedman, who is new on the scene. He's a very young man. And looking at his picture, I would say he's just past boyhood. He's going to probably hear a lot of Mutti Friedman. He is not related to any of the other Friedmans, like Benny Friedman or Avner Fried, as far as I could see. And we're listening to a piece. This is called Zecher L'Chaim, Remember Us for Life.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. This week's portion is the portion of Vayera and can be found in the book of Genesis, chapter 16 and following. One of the famous stories in this week's portion is the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and vicinity. I want to talk a little bit about that story specifically. It's interesting to note that why was Sodom and Gomorrah destroyed had nothing to do with what most people think of when they think of Sodom. Oh, that city, it's a real Sodom and Gomorrah. But rather, the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back was involved an act of charity, or actually a law about charity. See, Sodom had this interesting judicial system. They passed a law. They didn't want people. Listen, it says it's like Kagan Hashem. It's in last week's portion. It said it was like the Garden of God. It was such a beautiful place. They didn't want homeless people coming into their city. They didn't want indigents. They didn't want people bothering, please give me charity. So they made a rule that anybody who gave anybody charity was deserving of capital punishment. And indeed, what happened? Lot's daughter, Lot moved there last week, Avram's nephew, gave a blind man charity. She was turned into the authorities. There was a trial. She was found guilty. Her body was smeared with honey, and she was placed in a beehive and stung to death. Her cries pierced the heaven, and the Almighty said, that's it. So it wasn't because of immodest, immoral behavior that caused the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. It was the very breakdown of societal fabric with the destruction or the perversion of their legal system. When that happened, the Almighty said, no, this can no longer be perpetrated. So the stories in the Bible are not stories. We say this, probably almost every show. The stories of the Bibles are lessons to us. And so we have to take heed from the stories, this story specifically, because obviously we wouldn't want to get destroyed. So you have to say then, what do we learn from the story of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah is that people have to be honest with themselves and be honest with others and to deal with people in a way which shows honesty and integrity and forthrightness. I just want to say very quickly, this whole thing after the election with the protests and riots afterwards, I see it. I usually don't make political statements, but this is not political. It says this is the moral fabric of which this country is made. I'll let you in on a secret. Had I not gone into the rabbinate, I would have been a constitutional lawyer. That was where I was leaning until I discovered Judaism. And the foundation of the Constitution, and which is the foundation of this country, is such that you like it, you don't like it, that's fine. And thank God you have the opportunity to voice your opinion. But no one has the right to hurt someone else. No one has the right to destroy someone else's property. And no one has the right to do anything which would be considered anarchy. That's not guaranteed by our Constitution. And such behavior is totally and completely wrong. Not to end off on the word wrong in my little monologue over here, the best thing is we have to realize that the guy next to you, I would say if this wasn't Detroit, the guy next to you sitting on the bus, but how many, I have never been on a bus in Detroit. I'm here 30 years. The guy next to you, he's a person too. And his values are his values. And he came up with every reason he came up with his values. But tolerance and empathy is what it's all about. We're going to take a quick commercial break and be back with an exciting Hasidic story. Don't go away. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for The Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Herschel Finman, you're listening to The Jewish Hour. You want to get in touch with me? The best way? RabbiFinman.com. RabbiFinman. And I want to give a shout out to Steve in Dobbs Ferry, New York. Steve tells me that he is remodeling his own basement single-handedly, a daunting task. But the few hours that he spends each week, he listens to the most recent episode of the show and goes back and listens to a podcast, which can be found on The Jewish Hour. Or if you can't find it there, because we only have a year's worth, and there are going back to 2009 shows going back. You could listen to Stitcher on or on iTunes. So kudos to you, and let's keep the basement going there, Steve. You'll also find archived editions of the E-Parsha, U-Parsha, Hasidic U-Story, in which yours truly conveys the messages of Judaism in a hopefully entertaining and insightful way. And it's all short. I believe in brevity. You'll also find the very important donations page. November, we got off to a real slow start. When you want to say slow, I'm going to say slow start. We haven't even touched it. Baruch Hashem, August, September, October, gone. They're history. We don't have to talk about them anymore. I will never mention them, never, ever again. November, we live in the present. Go to the computer, click on the donations page. Click a number that you like. If you have PayPal, the whole thing will take you 30 seconds. You can even set up monthly giving. We got a lot of monthly givers last month, and we appreciate those wonderful people. Small donations, $18, $25, wonderful things. And I'm very happy that people were able to do that. And then you don't have to worry about it ever again until your credit card expires. Any amount will do. If you don't like doing internet giving, understood, send your donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. The Baal Shem Tov was traveling between point A and point B, and he came into this little village known in Yiddish as a shtetl, which means little village. And he passed by one of the little shtiebel, which is a small synagogue. And there he noticed something very unusual was going on, something very spiritual, holy was there. So he went inside, and he saw this man was just doing his morning prayers. And the Baal Shem Tov sat and waited, and the man prayed until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So as the person was like putting away his prayer items, the Baal Shem Tov went up to him and greeted him and said, "Tell me, why does it take you so long to pray?" And he says, "To tell you the truth, I'm a very ignorant person. I don't know the meaning of the words. I can't follow directions in the Siddur. So what I do every morning is I start from the very beginning and I read the whole entire book." So the Baal Shem Tov said to him, that's not necessary. He says, you know what? We'll sit down. We'll go through it. And the Baal Shem Tov took little pieces of paper, and he wrote down what goes where and what's said where. And the man was so happy that now he didn't have to spend all day davening, didn't have to spend all day praying. They said goodbye. And the man went on his way, and the Baal Shem Tov went on his way. As soon as he got outside, the Baal Shem Tov went one way. The man went the other way. As soon as the man got out of the synagogue, he tripped, dropped the book. This is before the age of post-it notes. The papers went flying. He went, Rebbe, Rebbe, wait, please, please, please. Baal Shem Tov didn't hear him. He's chasing after the Baal Shem Tov over hill and dale. Finally, the Baal Shem Tov came to a river. The Baal Shem Tov took out a handkerchief, put it on the water, stepped on the handkerchief, and floated across. The man saw this, didn't see any bridge, said, okay, fine. Took out a handkerchief, put it on the water, stood on a handkerchief, and floated across, and very shortly thereafter caught up the Baal Shem Tov. And he said, Rebbe, Rebbe, please, you need to, the papers fell out, we have to do it again. The Baal Shem Tov said, how did you catch up to me so quickly? He said, well, I saw you do the thing with the handkerchief, I did it too. Baal Shem Tov said, I think the Almighty is happy with your prayers. So it just requires a full heart. That's going to do it. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you back again next week. Take care.